self-build relationship with God as well, and it's wonderful to do. So I encourage you just to come along and invite a friend along and bring him along. That'd be fantastic. This week we're on week four of a series that we started called Disciple. There it is. And Jesus, we said, and this is probably throwing you all, isn't it? Because now you're going out and you're saying, how do I refer to myself now? This is a bit like life groups, isn't it? And I said, no, you've got all life groups now, and everybody keeps mentioning home groups, and they're correcting themselves. And they're like, oh, hang on, that's not enough. And you're probably the same boat with yourself now. Am I a Christian? Should I refer to myself as Christian, or should I say I'm a disciple of Jesus, or what should I call myself? So don't worry, about 3 weeks time we forget all about it and we'll go back home. But the point is, it's making you think about what you are and what Jesus says you are. And that's the point. And we recognize Jesus never referred to you as Christian or to the people who followed him. He never used that term. He never used it. It's only used 3 times in the whole of the Bible, and it's never defined. And that's because it was a term used by outsiders as a description of the people who followed Jesus. It was never used by the disciples themselves or themselves. It was used by people outside. And his early followers took that term, they took the word disciple, and they took it so seriously, let me tell you what happened. This is what they did. Because they took that word, that definition of who they are, so seriously. This is what happened. If you visit Rome today, which was at one point the centre of the world's biggest superpower, the Roman Empire, military and political superpower, occupied the known world. If you visit Rome today, you will find every single building, in so many buildings, nearly every building, you will find crosses on the top of buildings, on the side of buildings, on the streets, everywhere you'll find crosses. There's even a cross in the slave gate and in the emperor's gate of the great Colosseum of Rome. This is the cross at the emperor's gate in the Colosseum of Rome. The place where they threw Christians, as they called them, to the lions and to the gladiators. And if we go back in time to 64 AD, Nero blamed the fire of London on Christians, he called them that, and he's throwing them to the lions and burning them, and yet he's in the gate that he would have walked through is now cross. And if you ask in 64 AD a Christian who was fleeing that persecution, if you went outside into the hills around Rome where the Christians were running because they put bounties on Christians' heads, they said, these guys are blamed, it's their fault, which it wasn't, it was Nero, we're pretty sure it was Nero who set the fire in order to renovate Rome, and then he blamed the Christians because that was convenient. Even the Roman historians acknowledged that, and they weren't Christians. But they knew he'd framed everybody else. But if you went and found a Christian who was running for their life, who had a bounty on their head, if you said to them, listen, one day Rome will be adorned with crosses in honour of the man the Romans crucified and murdered and executed, and one day the temples to Jupiter will be tourist attractions, and nobody will be worshipping Apollo or Mars or any of the other Roman gods. They will cease to exist as gods in the world. And one day people will make pilgrimages to Nero's circus, because on Nero's circus, the spot where he murdered so many Christians and framed them up, on that spot will be a cathedral built in honour of a fisherman called Peter, who was a disciple of Jesus, this guy they crucified. If you said, in a few hundred years that's going to happen, they would have looked at you and they would have said, what are you smoking? I mean, look at our world, look at what's going on. We are running for our lives. Me and my family, we are in hiding because it doesn't look like that. It's not what it looks like. Yet within 300 years, that's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened. How? Well, it didn't happen because the followers of Jesus embraced the term Christian. They didn't know what that meant. It wasn't even defined. It wasn't because they embraced that term. It happened because the followers of Jesus embraced the terms he gave to them, the words and the descriptions that he put on them. And they embraced it, and it conquered the Roman Empire without ever drawing a sword within 300 years. That is amazing. That is amazing. So today what I thought I'd do is I would read you the speech that started this amazing movement that toppled an empire peacefully and without violence and without coercion or force. But I'm going to read you the speech that kicked it all off, the one that was the foundation for this movement, okay? And this is how it starts. You'll be familiar with these words. Because one day it says, Jesus saw the crowds gathered, a huge crowd was starting to follow him. And he went up on a mountainside and he sat down, and his disciples, his new word Christians, he said, these are my disciples. His disciples gathered around him and he began to teach them. So are you ready for this groundbreaking speech that would one day turn the world upside down and transform our lives as we know it? Here we go. Here comes the revolutionary speech that toppled Rome. Here you go. Ready? Here it comes. God bless us, or blessed are, God bless us, those who are poor and realize their need for him, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs. God blesses those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Good stuff, isn't it? This is world-changing, empire-toppling stuff, right? Yeah? Convinced? Maybe not. Let's keep going. Maybe it gets better. God bless us. Blessed are those who are humble. The meek is the original translation. God bless us. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. God bless us those who hunger and thirst for justice, for they will be satisfied. And I suspect in the back of the crowd, that huge crowd, one day somebody stuck up a hand and said, sorry, Jesus, could I just interrupt you a minute? Blessed are the meek. Do you know anything about Rome, Jesus? Do you know we as a nation haven't been free for a very long time? The meek will inherit the earth, Jesus. We can't control our own land. Where has meek gotten us, Jesus? How is this going to change the world? Really? Seriously? And Jesus goes on. God bless us. Blessed are those who are merciful, for they will be shown mercy. God bless us those whose hearts are pure, for they will see God. God bless us those who work for peace, for they will be called the children of God. Hang on, Jesus. Sorry, it's me again. Sorry. Can I just ask a good question? Do you really think we're going to retake the world, change the world, by being peacemakers? Do you know what happens to people who make peace with Rome? They disappear. They get absorbed. They become just one of another vassal nation under the boot of Rome. Do you know what happens to the people who make peace? But Jesus goes on, and he keeps going on with this movement creating speech. God blesses those who are persecuted. This is getting worse, isn't it? God blesses those who are persecuted for doing right, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs. God blesses those. God blesses you when people mock you and persecute you and lie about you and say all sorts of evil things against you, because you are my followers. Here we go, and it gets worse. Be happy about it. Be happy about getting trampled upon. Be very glad, for a great reward awaits you in heaven. And remember, the ancient prophets were persecuted in the same way. Okay, got that, folks? Let's go and change the world. And in any of you, would you be convinced that this is going to transform the globe? I don't think I would. I suspect there was silence. I suspect the tumbleweed rolled across like the movies. And it'd be like, you want us to be that? And that's going to change the world. Let's do a quick review, just in case you've missed it. Here's what Jesus says you are. He doesn't use the word Christians. He says, you are this, and this will change the world. You ready? Here you go. You are poor, sad, meek, righteous, merciful, pure, peaceful, persecuted, insulted people waiting for a reward in heaven. That's who you are. Anybody want to sign up? I'm not getting people to be members of the church, let alone that. Yeah, this is what Jesus says. This is what we need to be. This is what you should be. If you are my disciples, this is the movement. This is what we are. I don't know if Jesus winked at that moment. But I do know, 300 years later, the message of Jesus, and that particular message, is still flowing around 2,000 years later, and it is. The Sermon on the Mount is regarded as one of the most powerful and amazing speeches ever made. And the God of Jupiter is assigned to the history books just 300 years after he said this. How did that happen? Well, Jesus probably saw the expression on their faces because they were going, you want us to be that? That's going to change everything. And he goes on to give us two word pictures to try and explain why this works, why it will make a difference. And he gives us two word pictures to explain who we are. Here's the first one. You are the salt of the earth. Try this. Try and get it this way. You're all those things, but you are the salt of the earth. That's what it means. Everybody in Jesus' audience knew what that was. They all knew, as Ben has explained, salt was a preservative, something that added to prevent decomposition. When there's no preservative, things go bad. Things deteriorate. Things, quite literally, start to stick when there is no preservative. Jesus was saying, you are the preservative of the earth. Without you, culture, without you, society starts to rot and go bad. Jesus was speaking to a world where really it was very different to ours. And we have a problem with this because we think the world has always looked like modern day Britain, democracy, rule of law, all that stuff. It didn't. And in fact, that has only happened for a few hundred years. But the vast majority of human history, you know what? How it ran? Might determines right. If you had the biggest army, you chose what was right and wrong. You made the rules up by force. That's how the world was run for thousands and thousands of years, and certainly in Jesus' day. Might determines right. The powerful ran things. The people with the biggest army and stick were declared right. Women, therefore, had no rights. Thousands of years, women have had no rights because the men had the armies. The men had the power, the force. Children, no rights whatsoever because they weren't powerful, they weren't mighty, they couldn't force their way into things. And mercy and compassion and generosity for thousands of years have not been considered virtues. They have not been considered virtues for most of human history. They are the possession of the weak. For most of history, that's the truth. That's how it works. It was a world we in the West have never experienced, and you have to today, if you want to experience what it feels like and looks like to live in that sort of environment, you have to go to a third world, usually a third world war-torn country where there is civil war and where law has broken down and justice has broken down, and whoever has enough guns and enough power determines what goes on. That's what it's been like for most of human history. That's what it's looked like. And what we consider normal today isn't. It's very recent. It's very recent. Because we live in a nation underpinned, you may not realise it, underpinned by the stuff Jesus is talking about here. All that stuff that we take for granted, that we believe is normal, came from that. It's what eventually, after some false starts, finally banned slavery and said it's wrong. It's eventually promoted equality for women. It eventually began to treat children as precious, even though they had no right and no way of forcing their own rights on the world. Why do we now view, have you ever thought about this? Why do you view generosity as good? I mean, where did that come from in the evolution of society? Where on earth did that idea that generosity is a virtue and a good thing to be strived for in a world where most of the time power rules? Where did that come from? And yet in our culture today, we all admit, whether you have faith or no faith, generosity is a good thing. Where did that come from? Why do we see compassion as a positive thing in somebody's life today? Why do we all view that? Whether we practice it or not, we all say that being compassionate is a laudable thing. So where did that come from? In a world where the armies rule. It came because it's a reflection of a worldview that believes there is one single God who values everybody equally and who are all equally accountable to Him. Underpinning it all is that. And it's because the first century disciples believed what Jesus said. They took it seriously and they spread it around the globe. And what we take as normal ethics and moral codes and virtues and principles and values today all stem from that. It's the only explanation for it to be there. It came from that. And Jesus was saying to the crowd, he was saying this, "You're the salt of the earth. You have no standing, but you are the last stand. You are the last stand, because things can't go on the way they've become. We have to change it. We have to bring some new principles, some new ethics, some new values into this world, and it's not going to be might anymore. It's going to be something else. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are the righteous, the just, the just. Blessed are those people. You are the preservative of the earth. And without the earth, without you, the earth will stink. But this one thing, by this one thing, everybody will know you are disciples. How you love, how you treat, how you respect one another, that is all new. That was all new in Jesus' day, in the middle of the Roman Empire. And today, every one of us benefits from it because these disciples actually believe Jesus, when he stood on that hillside and said, "This is who we are, and this will change the world." And it did. It's amazing, but it did. It shouldn't have done, but it did. And somehow, the armies didn't get the last word. Not only are you the salt of the earth, he said, the preservative of the world, because you are these things, because you love one another. You're also the light of the world. You're the light of the world. In Jesus' day, the world was rather small. Most people never travelled more than about 15 miles from their front door. They would never travel in their whole life more than that. And he said, "You're the light of the world. You're like a city." And it's, as some translations say, built, but actually place is a better translation of the Greek. You're a city placed. Strategically placed on a hilltop that cannot be hidden. They were a specifically placed people. Jesus says that's who you are. You're strategically placed. So that people would see you as so you can have an influence on the world. Most of us would argue with that. Most of us will argue that when we think, has God strategically placed me? Am I the light of the world? Am I strategically placed so that I can make a difference? Most of us would argue with that, because most of us came to where we are, or to work where we are, or to live where we are, for a whole vast number of reasons. Some of them we had no control over, didn't we? Maybe, you know, for some of us it may be a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and we ended up moving there, and we ended up staying there, and that's why we're here. For some of us it was a job move, or a job loss, and we just had to look for another job, and it took us here. And, you know, there are all sorts of reasons. Maybe a family member, and there were problems and issues, you had to move to be nearer them, and that. But I'm not strategically placed. I'm just here because I'm here because of circumstances, and it's all a little bit random. Jesus says, no. You are strategically placed where you are. You are here to shine, and I've put you there. It says this, the same way. Shine in the same way. Let your good deeds shine out for all to see, so that everyone will praise your Father in heaven. Jesus says, I want you to live in such a way that when they see your good deeds, they don't say, what a nice guy you are. I don't want them to say that. I don't want you to do something nice and then say, what a wonderful woman that is. I don't want that. That's not what I'm talking about. I want your good deeds to be so extraordinary, in other words, so out of the ordinary, so different to the way everybody else operates, extraordinary, not what ordinary people do. I want you to be like that, so that people start connecting the dots between you and God. Not just so they say, what an nice bloke you are, but so they say, well, ordinary people don't do that. What's different? And then make the connection between you and God. That's what I want you to be and what I want you to do. That's what Jesus said. Your light has to be brighter than anybody else's. You have to be more generous. You have to be more forgiving. You have to be more compassionate. And when the guy in your office blows it badly and gets it wrong, a genuine mistake, you're the one as the boss who doesn't just automatically fire them and get rid of them or dump them. Maybe you're the guy of the second chance. But everybody else would have fired them, but you don't. He says, let your good deeds be so different from the world around you that everybody connects the dots and it leads to understanding something about God. Really, Jesus? Do I have to do this? Can't I just be a Christian? This goodness knows what that means anyway. Can't I just be a Christian? Can't I just say a prayer and go to heaven? Do I have to be salt? And do I have to be light as well? And the followers of Jesus were exactly what Jesus called them to be. Salt and light. And the first followers of Jesus were exactly that. They took the band of kids into their homes and they adopted them. That's what they did. Took them into their homes and adopted them. And when disease broke out and everybody fled from the town because the plague had turned up, you know what? Even the pagan priests will be the first one to get out because they have the ill person dragged in front of them and they go, oh, I know what that is. Right, everybody out, pack the bags, love. And they would clear off. You know what the Christians would do? They would stay. And people started seeing this behaviour and they started joining some dots. And they didn't just say, they're great. They said, there's something different. What do you believe? In fact, Christians would risk their lives routinely. And the papers around them, the non-believers around them would say, why aren't you afraid of death? Why are you hanging around in this plague-ridden town? Why are you treating the sick and risking your own health? Why are you taking kids into your homes and you're broke already? Why are you risking your own lives? Why are you doing this? Why aren't you afraid of death like the rest of us? Do you know why I weren't afraid of death like the rest of us? Something to do with a guy called Jesus, for whom death was not an issue. What do you know about death that we don't, so that you're able to live so radically differently in this world and even risk your lives for others? And they join the dots. In just a few hundred years, they turn the world upside down, not because of good teaching or preaching. Galls me to say that. But they didn't change the world. You know what did? Believers who were salt, and that changed the world. Not the preachers. The followers of Jesus who were salt and light and took him seriously. That changed the world. Here's what I think Jesus says to us today, 2017, January. This is what Jesus says to the church today. He says this. Don't settle for Christian. We don't even know what that means. That was a label put on us by someone at the time. Don't settle for an undefined term. Here's what you are. Here's what you are. Be salt. Be light. Change the world. Be a preserver and a light, and live a lifestyle that points to Jesus. And it sounds like a story, doesn't it? But it's not all that complicated. It's not. I can guarantee one of the reasons some of you are sat here today is because somebody was salt and light to you. You can think of it, can't you? What was their name? They were salt and they were light to you. And that's changed the direction, the trajectory of your life, because they were salt. They were preservative, they were light, they guided, they shone, their life was, their deeds were, made you look to God and connect the dots. I suspect they didn't realise they were doing it. I suspect the people who were doing that, just meeting you for a coffee or being your friend or just encouraging or helping you out in some way, I suspect they didn't realise or consciously think, I'm going to be salt today, I'm going to be light today. I suspect they didn't even think that. I suspect they didn't believe that they were strategically placed in your life at that moment. But here's what I believe. I believe you would say they were. They were salt and light to me. They were there at that moment when I most needed somebody to show me a way. God put them there. He would even say, wouldn't you? And I would it for the people in my life. God put them into my life at that moment and it changed my life. They probably wouldn't say that. They probably didn't realise that at the time. Isn't that wonderful? You'd be salt and light without ever knowing you do. But the people you influence will know and will one day acknowledge you. So if you're a student today, you're salt in your university, you're light in your school. And you say, oh no, I'm not, I have no influence, nobody even knows my name. I can't even find my locker without a guy. I'm not salt and light. What are you talking about, food? But here's what you need to know. Here's what you need to know if you're doubting this. Salt always preserves. And light always shines the way. It can't help it, it just does it. By being there. Salt works by being there, even though you can't see it working. Light works. It shines. It illuminates. It reveals. It shows a way just by being there, just by existing. And you may not feel like you're salt and light, but trust me, this isn't rocket science. Just by being there and being what Jesus defined you as, you will change things. If you're in an office tomorrow and everybody says it's okay, it's how business is done, that's modern world, and that's how we do stuff now, and you choose to work a different way, you're being salt. You're being salt. And they might not like it. It might make them feel uncomfortable that you don't go with that. That you say, no, I need to do it this way because this is who I am. This is what I'm defined as. So I'm doing it this way. and they might feel guilty about that. They might even give you a hard time about that because of how it makes them feel in response to how you're behaving. They may be too proud to acknowledge what you're doing, or that actually secretly they'd love the courage to make a stand on that themselves. They probably would never admit it to you. But I'll bet it makes an impact. And I'll bet 5 years down the line, they'll remember you. You'll stand out. You'll shine in a way that all the other employees never did. Never did. They'll remember you. I've never forgotten that guy. There's something about him. Never said it, but there was. I remember that now. Claudia listens to Joyce Meyer every day, and she does that for a devotion. So Joyce Meyer is a Christian author and speaker, and she told me a little bit about Joyce's history. And Joyce Meyer came from quite an abusive background. She was abused as a child, and that really messed her up in all sorts of ways, and she was deeply unhappy in life. And she made a decision, you know what, I'm unhappy, I think everybody else ought to be unhappy too. That was her sort of philosophy in life when she started out. She's a lovely, cheerful person to know, got invited to a lot of parties. If I'm miserable, everybody else is going to be miserable, because it's awful when they're happy and I'm not, and it just reminds me. So that's how I'm going to operate. And subconsciously, that's what she was doing. Why should everybody else be happy if she wasn't? And that included her new husband, Dave. Dave, who rather bravely portrayed, God, send me a wife I can help. Guys, God, send me a wife I can be salt and light to. And he did. So watch out what you're praying for. And he prayed for that. And you know what he did? You know what he did? So he marries Joyce, and then she uses her philosophy of, you can't be happy if I'm not happy. And he decided, I'm not living like that. So he was happy. He was inordinately happy. Do you know how much that wound the Joyce Meyer up? She said the more happy he got, the more angry I got with him, the more frustrated I got with him, the more I wanted to hit him. He just was happy all the time. He drove her mad. This went on for 9 years, and he thought, he just decided, I am not going to be an unhappy person just because my wife is. I am going to be a happy person. I'm going to do it. And she said, every single day he was a mirror of what I wasn't, but what I so desperately wanted to be. He was a mirror of that. But he was the last person I was going to tell that to. Because to tell him would be to admit that I was wrong. To tell him would be to expose my sin. To tell him would be to expose and admit my pride. So I wasn't going to tell him. I just got more and more frustrated with him. The more happy he got, the more frustrated I got. And after 9 years, eventually, she just broke. Broke the cycle in her life. She just realised, this is stupid. What am I doing? Because he was salt and light, and salt always preserves, and light always shines the way. And he just stuck at it for 9 years, and he was nearly ready to quit, he says. He was. After 9 years, he was there. Forget this. But he hung in there, and by being there, it broke a cycle in her life, and she went on to become, if you've read her books and listened to her, just an amazing influence and impact on so many, particularly women's ministry, particularly just an amazing ministry to women, and lifting them up and encouraging them, building them up and changing their attitude. And all that sort of stuff. Amazing. They've been married for 45 years now. Salt always preserves. Light always shows the way. By being. By being what Jesus says you are. And just like that story, we have no idea who is around us. Who seems right now so hostile. In fact, more hostile than when we started. Who seems so hardened right now, who maybe on the very edge of a breakthrough, on the very edge of letting that salt and light finally influence them and change them. And there may be people around you. In fact, some people may be feeling like they're getting worse. That's a good sign. That means you're getting to it. That means you're getting to it. If they're getting worse, it means you're getting to it. It means they're seeing it and it's frustrating them and they just don't want to go there yet. But they're close. They're closer than they were. They might move on. Sometimes they might move on never having done it, never having changed. But here's what you need to know. Salt always preserves and light always shows the way. Be those things. You may never know the end of the story, but that is true, says Jesus. That is true. So don't just suffer, Christian. Let's be salt of the earth. Let's be the light of the world. Jesus says, this is what you are. This is the label. And here's what we know. When you are, stuff like that happens. The world gets changed. We know it's happened before. We just have to believe it can happen again. Let's pray, shall we? Father, sometimes we settle for a label, a term, a definition of who we are, and there isn't one. We settle for Christian, and it means, well, I prayed a prayer, and one day I'll go to heaven. And that's it, isn't it, Lord? That's it. And you're saying to us, well, I never called you that. I called you my disciples, my apprentices, my learners, my followers. I called you salt, and I called you light. That is who you are. If you follow me, that is who you are. And Lord, preserve us from just being Christian, whatever that means. And let us grab hold again of what you meant when you said, follow me. And we know it works. We know this changed the world. And we've taken it so much for granted, we don't even notice it in our culture, in our values, in our world. We know you changed the world. And so did those disciples, because they believed you. And they began to be what you called them to be. Will you help us to do the same? Will you give us the courage and the faith to be salt, to be light, and to be your disciples. We ask in Jesus' name, and all God's people said, Amen.